Morning, my name is Bob Bazans and I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and the power of AA, I haven't had to have a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. This has been a wonderful weekend. So many times when you commit yourselves a long time ahead of time to go someplace, when the weekend shows up, you don't want to go. And I often have that experience when I'm on holidays. And I also, once I do go, I also have the experience that I'm very glad I came. And this has been especially one of those. I'm kind of impressed with the conference that has the voice of the conference have 37 years of sobriety. I think that's a pretty good deal. I was with Mary last night after Karen talked, and she told me a couple of racy stories. She's a real alcoholic. And I won't tell you exactly what she told me, other than they didn't have super glue, but they did have nail polish in those days. And so you do qualify, Mary. I think that's wonderful. Yeah, a couple of my favorite people here this weekend. Mildred is my wife. Says hello, by the way, Mildred, and is one of my favorite women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's real always a pleasure to be with Mildred. I haven't been with her for quite a while, and then all of a sudden we get thrown together two or three times, so it's been pretty nice. Tom Ivester is one of my heroes in AA. I don't know a man who I think has more vision and more energy and serves our fellowship as well as I think Tom does, and it's always great to be with Tom. And David and Grace, David and I got sober in the same year, and David has been a guy who's always had a strong influence on my sobriety, both in service and in talking. And he and Grace have been like, as Grace said, she thinks of me as one of her kids, have been almost kind of like sponsors for me in AA, so that's been great. And with Karen and Dozier and Bill and everybody else, we've had an awfully nice weekend. I started drinking, and I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Dottie for that wonderful sampler that I'm going to have up. I have to decide now which room to put it in, but it's kind of nice. As Tom said, with these plaques, you don't know exactly what to do with them, but I'll figure out something exactly what to do with Dottie's deal. I lost a tooth just before I came here, which is always kind of nice. I've always been a guy who believes in form over substance. You know, my mother always said, "You're not very bright, Bob. Dress well." And I try to do that. And so this has been kind of a exercise in humility for me to be up here looking like Alfred E. Newman. So if I isn't it funny? You little things you drag around with you. I've always had a bad deal about my teeth. And as a kid, I had a lot of cavities, but the teeth looked okay. And then when I was drinking, I got a steering wheel in the mouth. And, I didn't exactly get a steering wheel in the mouth. I got punched in a, when I was in school, I got into a fight and I chipped the tooth. I came home to get the tooth fixed, and then I got into a car accident and I got the steering wheel in the mouth and I lost all my front teeth and had to have them capped. So for the last 30 years, these teeth have been loose in front. I've been worried, you're worried daily that you're going to lose them. And now I did, finally the bone structure won't support it and one fell out before I came here. And I never identified how badly I felt about how I handled myself during that period of time. I started drinking when I was 14 years old. And I was a small kid. I was 4'11". I weighed 95 pounds. I was the second smallest kid in my high school class. And I was always compensating. I was one of seven kids. And I think mother always said if she sent me to school again, she'd send me a year later. But I was, kind of a preemie, and I was one of the youngest kids in my class. So I had a big mouth. I was always trying to get attention. I was always trying to fit in. I was always trying to belong. And I was a jokester and got in a lot of trouble. I got kicked out of grade school, 30, 40 times. I was always I was Bugsy. I've got a couple of kids that are attention deficit, and I think I had whatever that disease is or whatever that syndrome is called today. And when I got to high school, it was, again, I just wanted to be part of the cool group. There always seemed to be a group of people who knew more about the business of living than I knew. It was like they got to school an hour early and had a meeting. And I missed the meeting, and I was always trying to catch up and find out what was going to go on that day, because it seemed like everybody else knew and I didn't. Well, when I went to my first party and I got a fifth of booze, and we went out and we split that fifth of booze, my life changed. And you hear that story in all sorts of different ways. I was just a setup for it. Alcohol made me feel like I belonged. It made me feel part of. It took away the disease that I had, and it was like I found the answer when I found alcohol. I chased alcohol from the moment I got it as hard and as fast as a young guy my age could. By the time I finished high school, my drinking was a loud subject of conversation in my home. I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought, you know, hell, I'm underage. I went to a military school on a college campus. And of my five closest friends in high school, four of us are in Alcoholics Anonymous and one's in Al-Anon. In my high school class of 125 guys, I know of 12 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Two or three of us almost died of alcohol poisoning in high school. We were heavy drinkers. You know, we made false IDs. We had fraternities in high school. We drank in high school like most people drink in college or harder. So I had a chance to go away to college and kind of get away from my parental authority, and I went away to the University of Notre Dame, and in the middle of my senior year, I walked out. I drank my way through the University of Notre Dame. I was in civil engineering. I was carrying 25 credits a semester, and it's kind of hard to bluff your way through a thermodynamics exam. It's just, you know, I was petitioned by three guys in my engineering class to be removed from the engineering class of Notre Dame. I literally was the class drunk. I was in trouble from the moment I walked into Notre Dame to the time I left. I had to get a medical release to get out of Notre Dame. Now, when I went there, that was a big deal for me. That was always, when you talk about unfinished pieces of business, you know, when I didn't finish Notre Dame, that seemed like a major failure, and people always ask you simple questions like, where did you go to school, and you never know exactly what to tell them. I mean, you know where you went to school. Do you want the one I finished, or the one I went in between, or the one, you know? Simple questions for alcoholics just aren't simple questions, you know, like, are you married? You know, and a guy gets this kind of perplexed look on his face. I mean, he knows, he just doesn't know how much time you have. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, do you have any children? You know, and it just, these are, employers don't understand that these are. So whenever people ask me where I went to school, I was always kind of an unfinished piece of business. And as God would have it, when I was sober about 15 years, I got a chance to go back down to Notre Dame and talk down there at an AA conference. I was right in the middle of my talk, and I said, you know, I've always had a deep sense of failure about this place. And I said, I just figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. So, took me 15 years, but I got to it. I had to get a medical release, and the medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic by my psychiatrist when I was 19 years old. And I see that psychiatrist from time to time today, and he used to have me go down to the psych ward and pick up some of his patients who had alcohol problems. We hear a lot of talk about doctors who don't know much about alcoholism, but this is what in 1961 or two diagnosed me as an alcoholic and recommended that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So there are people who do know what our disease is and what to do about it. I finished, when I left Notre Dame, I came home and I finished school. My father asked me to leave home. He said, I love you and I care about you, but there's six other kids in the family, and you're a mess, and you're not following the rules, and good luck. And armed with my college degree and my freedom, I went out to make my mark on the world and took a position as a carryout boy in a liquor store. And actually, with the delivery guy, I almost killed a little girl backing up with that truck one morning when I was drunk. And I lost that job for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck. I took a job as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis. I'm living on Skid Row. I have an apartment in St. Paul, but I'm working in downtown Minneapolis, 7 miles away, and I think in the 6 months I was a waiter, I made it home about five nights. I just lived out of two paper bags in my locker. I'm drinking a fifth a day. I get up in the morning, take a couple of beers, a couple of Dextrin, I go to work, and I work as a waiter from 11 to 2. And at 2, I go to a bar and I drink beer from 2 to 5, and at 5, I go buy a fifth and put it in my locker and pour it into a half-pint bottle. And sometime during that day or the previous days, I figured out where I was going to bunk out and who I was going to live with. You know, Dr. Seuss, that child author, those are actual photographs of people I lived with during that period of time in my life. It was not a good time. And I was at a party one night, and I got the hell beat out of me, and they fired me because of didn't want me serving food, looking the way I looked, and I was tapped. I had no place to go, and I went back to the family, and I said, "Can I come back?" And they said, "Yeah, if you promise not to drink, you can come back." And like a good little drunk, I promised not to drink. And, you know, alcoholism meant a lot of different things to me, but maybe what it meant more than anything else is about every 6 months I had to start my life over. I forget which speaker was talking about the series. I think it was Tom about the series of starting over. And every time I was going to start over, it was going to be different. And this time when I came back, I made maybe the largest full-court press of pulling my act together that I had ever done. I wanted to put a different structure in my life. And I decided if I could get married, that it'd be a better structure. You know, most people who are married have their life together, right? And I didn't. I wanted a better job, and I was screwing around waiting to see if I could get out of the service. And so I got back together with a woman that I had gone with for a number of years and broken up with for about a year, and we became engaged to be married, and today she's my very lovely wife, Linda. I got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern, and I bought my first car. And I thought, hey, it's finally going to happen. You're really going to be what you always wanted to be when you grew up, only it didn't happen because I couldn't shut my drinking down. I was a bar drinker, and I just couldn't shut it down. Now I'm a company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers, and I stand out like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. You know, I use up my sick leave in the first 2 months that I'm at work, and I'm coming in late, and I'm falling asleep in the John, and people are paging me, and I'm bouncing off the walls with my legs asleep. You know, just classy sorts of stuff, you know, that you want to do. And I knew I was in trouble in that job, so I quit it after about 6 months. I took a job selling. And the sales job gave me the freedom that I always wanted, so they couldn't keep track of me. But I had that job about 3 or 4 months, and I went out in a four-day bender, and the first couple of days I called in, the next couple of days I didn't call in. And I woke up one afternoon, and I had it. I was scared, and I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live. And all of a sudden, the recommendations of my father and my psychiatrist that I call AA didn't seem so impossible, and I called Intergroup, and I got an old-timer on the phone, and he talked to me for about a half hour, and then he called someone else and asked me if I could meet a couple of guys at a cafe in about an hour, and I said that I could. And I went and I met two men, which changed my life sometime in July 1967. When you're young and in trouble, you get kind of walls in front of an awful lot of authorities and a lot of people who are trying to help you, judges and policemen and lawyers and doctors and deans and bishops and priests and nuns, and I've been kind of waltzed in front of a whole chain of people almost all my life. And I expected that when I was going to go meet two people from Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'd meet two authorities who would ask me a whole bunch of questions about myself. And when we were done asking the questions, they'd make a recommendation, because that was my experience. I'm 23 years old. I'm kind of scared. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I go over and I meet two guys at the cafe who changed my life. We have a lot of traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the great traditions that I think we have is we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our thinking. And these two men shared their life with me, and there's something that happens when someone shares their life with you that opens up a possibility that had never been opened up for me. With all the people that I had talked to about my alcoholism, I never had talked to another person who had it. I'd never talked to another person who had exactly my problem and have solved it themselves, and I was amazed at how the impact that these two men had on me. And I hope that that's something that we never get away from and know what our message is. Our message is our own experience. There's a power in that that we don't see very many. People always seem to share their concepts or share their philosophy, you know, and that doesn't have the power that your experience has. And these men literally changed my life that night. And they brought me to an AA meeting. I drank twice after walking into AA, once on a business trip to the West Coast with about 30 days of sobriety, and I didn't go to AA like my sponsor told me, and once on our honeymoon when I had about 3 months of sobriety. And, you know, we honeymooned in Acapulco, and you know where those divers dive off those cliffs in Acapulco? I dove off those cliffs in Acapulco on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. You know, I mean... And I went up and introduced myself to the ex-president of Mexico, and he wasn't very impressed with me, and his bodyguard wasn't very impressed with me. And then I had about 9 planters punches, and I went down. I dove off the public landing, climbed up the cliff. This was not classy. I split my swimsuit. I cut my leg. My wife's going absolutely nuts trying to get me down, and so are the policemen. I'm up there about 80 feet, and they dive from about 110, so I wasn't as high as they were, but I got stuck. I couldn't get up, and I couldn't get down, and I'm standing on this cliff, and I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive. And, waiting for the wave to come in. I finally figured out the hell with it, and I dove. And God watches after drunks and fools because I made it. We vacationed down there an awful lot of years after that, and I was down there with my wife and kids, and we were standing on the balcony one night watching the divers dive, and I said, God, that's the dumbest thing I ever did. And she said, honey, it's not even in the top 10. So I don't know why she has such a different view of our lives together. How two people could share life together and have such a different view of it. The last drink I have is on the airplane on the way home. I was allowed to make 2 discoveries which changed my life early on in Alcoholics Anonymous. One was that alcoholism was a disease. You say, well, God, everybody knows it's a disease, but I didn't know it was a disease. I thought it was kind of a moral failing. I thought it was something that was more physical than anything else. And I was surprised, really surprised, when the old-timers told me that the physical part of alcoholism, in their opinion, was about 10%. And that once I stopped drinking, what I had to do was use the 12 steps of the recovery program of AA to find a different way to live. If I didn't find a different way to live, I was doomed because I didn't know how to live without drinking. And that was about as true. Those old-timers, if anything has really saved my bacon, it's been wanting to be around the older members of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the things I really liked about Charlie and Mary and Dottie, and I'm blocking Dottie's husband's name. What I like is the old-timers. So many times we go, and I like people who stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so important for us. I don't like, Tom and I were discussing last night, every once in a while when you go to a countdown, I have been the oldest person, and I only have 27 years of sobriety. It's a horrible feeling. Everybody wants to be around the big guys, you know, and I've always wanted to be around people who had more experience than I had and who kind of broke the ice for me when I came in, and I've always been attracted to the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's, I think, been one of the main reasons that I've been able to stay since I came in. But I was told that alcoholism was a disease that was physical, also mental and spiritual, and that once I crossed the line from problem drinking, that my alcoholism into alcoholism, that my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I drank and when I didn't drink. It was very important to me to find out that there was something, because the worst troubles I had were sober. You know, I got into a hell of a lot of scrapes drunk, but I got, you know, when I was hungover or sober, I got into a hell of a lot of trouble and I wasn't able to function. And I thought there was something else wrong with me, then I thought drinking was my answer, not my problem. I thought drinking, for some reason, I don't know why I had all this tension and anxiety, and drinking relieved it. It caused me trouble once in a while, but by and large, it relieved it. I also felt that I had a lot of other issues. And you told me that I did have other issues, and they were, you know, that my problem wasn't drinking, it was alcoholism. And alcoholism wasn't just physical, but it was total. And that Alcoholics Anonymous dealt with that. The other discovery I made is that there was a whole lot of people who in those meetings who had drunk and taken an awful lot of drugs and now they weren't doing it. And the only reason that they weren't doing it is they liked what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. And that also intrigued me because it occurred to me that I might have to quit, but I thought my life was over. I didn't like people who didn't drink. I thought life would be real dull. And I looked at you and your lives were not over. There was a zest and a vitality and an energy and a humor that I have loved since the moment I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so glad that the God that I found in AA is a loving God and I was allowed to stay. I was the youngest guy in our group for almost 2 years. And I was 1 week after my 24th birthday. And I worked with, I don't know, over those first 4 or 5 years, I must have worked with at least 100 people close to my age. Every time there was a younger person that came in, for some reason they said, oh, gee, we got this young guy over here. And no one got sober. There was 1 or 2, I think, out of that entire group that got sober, but I stayed sober. And it just intrigued me. The gift that I got is I loved AA since the moment I walked in. And I couldn't figure out why these people didn't want to go to AA, why they didn't want to go to the meetings. I mean, I would, you know, it was baffling to me. And what it was for me was a gift. it didn't have to do with being smarter. There were plenty of guys and girls that I worked with that were smarter than I was when I came in. They needed it worse than I did, and they didn't stick, and they didn't like it. They didn't identify, and quite a few of those people are dead today. And I am eternally grateful that I have been able to live my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 52 years old today. Or not today. I'll be 52 years old in a couple of months. And I got sober when I was 24, and so I spent over half my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a guy who looked like I should do well in the business of living. When I left high school to go to Notre Dame, I had the best test scores of the people that went down there. I was the only one of the 14 kids from my high school that went to Notre Dame that didn't finish. Okay, I'm a guy who can pass the test. I'm the guy that can get the job, but I don't do it. Okay, I talk well, I dress well, but I don't perform. And it seemed like all my life in my family, I had this wonderful family. I really had a great family. I got six brothers and sisters, you know, three brothers and three sisters. And my dad died this last September, and he was my hero. God, he might have died today. He must be a year anniversary today. My dad was bigger than life. My dad was a very successful man. He was part of that Second World War crew that came back, that played hard and worked hard. They built businesses and had large families. And I grew up in a city that was an awful lot of Roman Catholics, and most of the families that I hung around with had, you know, anywhere from 6 to 15 kids. And we were like clans. We literally, you know, we had friends all the way down. I mean, I still run into, you know, my brothers and sisters, you know, we have about a 15-year range, and you have, you know, so wherever you go, in grocery stores and banks and different places, you run into people that went to school with your cousins or... And it was wonderful. I still live in the same city that I grew up in. I see people that I went to grade school with all the time. And my dad was a hero of mine. My dad also had the disease of alcoholism. And when I grew up, my dad never, during my formative years, I never thought my dad had a problem. My dad was a, you know, kind of a high-flying, wonderful guy. And he developed the problem more when he retired. And all of a sudden, he crossed some line, and he couldn't go back. And he was, you know... He'd find himself taking a bottle of brandy and a book and sitting down in the living room, and he'd, you know, polish off more of the bottle of brandy than he wanted to, and he had a serious problem, and he joined Alcoholics Anonymous about 23 years ago. And so I was the guy who was like born on third base and had been congratulating himself for hitting a triple. You know, there were an awful lot of things in my life that were okay from the moment that I came in. And by the time I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had worked myself back to first base, you know, and congratulated myself for just getting on base. But I was a guy who thought, you know, good starter, poor finisher. And now I found out that I got the answer. I got alcoholism. That's the reason I haven't been able to finish anything. And now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I figure, I got the problem, you got the answer. Well, if I got the problem and you got the answer, my life ought to all of a sudden take off. I now found out what the hell the problem was. So I expected that I would be a better salesman, a better husband, a better parent. My financial problems would be over. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I start real active in the program. I'm going to meetings. I'm starting to sponsor people. I'm, you know, studying the steps. I'm, you know, doing all the things that I think I'm supposed to do, and my life doesn't take off. I've got four or five issues that are in my life that I think are supposed to be corrected, and they're going nowhere. I couldn't get up in the morning. God, I'd set the alarm clock for 6:30, and I get up about 7:45. It's kind of hard to be at work at 8 if you get up at 7:45. It's not impossible for an alcoholic, but it's tough. You know, it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard on your heart, you know, and it got to sleep in your clothes and leave the car running. But it's, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of hard. I spent $200 or $300. Tom's been a little worried about me with all my sleeping this weekend. You'll be glad to know I woke up at 3 o'clock this morning, Tom, and read till 5. So, I'm balancing it out this weekend. And so I'd oversleep all the time. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made. If you do that over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're trying that one. You don't know where that goes. And I was newly married, and Linda had an expectation about marriage, and I had an expectation, and, you know, they're always a little bit different, and life wasn't. She had a dad who came home every night at 5 o'clock. I don't know if I have yet made it home at 5 o'clock, you know, in the 27 years of marriage. We had children, and I had a wonderful mom and dad, and so did Linda, and I wasn't going to make the few mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made the few mistakes they made and a whole bunch they never thought of. I was loud, angry, immature, impatient, and sometimes violent. I'm not proud of that, but that was an issue. Rage was an issue in my parenting. I had a gambling problem. It was more like a hobby. It was 3 or 4 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. And but I made about 10 grand a year playing backgammon. It was kind of like a second job. Now, these were problems that I had. And they weren't annual or quarterly or monthly or weekly. They were daily. And I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous with these secondary issues that were going on in my life. They didn't bother me at all almost my entire first year of sobriety. I don't know what, you know, I was just on a honeymoon when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just enthused. I wanted to find out about AA. I just immersed myself in the program. And I was on a honeymoon. But during my second year, I started to get in touch with my defects of character, and I had done an inventory early on, but it was more an inventory of my grosser problems when I was drinking. And all of a sudden, I'm starting to expand my inventory and get in touch with what's not working in my life. I start to take these issues on, and I try to apply the steps to them, and I try to change them, and it seemed like I wasn't making any progress. Not only did it seem like I wasn't making any progress, it seemed like I was going backwards. Now, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the first major thing I did with my recovery was to tear down my alibi system. I had built a wall up between you and me to hide the parts of me I didn't want you to see. And most of us have this kind of protective mechanism. We're pretty damn careful that we don't like to admit when we're wrong, because to admit that we're wrong in one area of our lives is to open up the question that we're wrong in an area of our lives that we aren't going to have the, we don't want the question called. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had this wall built up, and I had this idea that you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. But if you could see everything about me, you would hate me, because I hate me. And who knows more what a crummy person I am than me. I was walking around comparing my inside with your outside. Now, in order to really get involved in the steps, I had to tear that wall down. That started when I called AA, it continued when I had conversation with my sponsor, and it culminated when I took my fifth step. For the first time in my life, I tore my wall down and I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. See, up until that time, no one had the whole deck of cards. My psychiatrist didn't have it, my father didn't have it, my mother didn't have it, my brothers and sisters and my boss and my wife, no one had it. And I used to kill you with the piece you didn't have. You'd come to me and you'd say, Bob, I think you should do this. And I, in my mind, I could say, you think, you know, but there's a whole bunch of stuff you don't know about me. And if you knew that about me, you'd understand it was a different situation than you think it is. So thanks a lot for your concern. Why don't you just get off my back? So I could neutralize anybody who tried to help me because they didn't have the information, and I wouldn't give them the information. But when I started into the process of taking my fourth and fifth step, and when I started in the process of my surrender when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in my first step, I tore that wall down and I made a discovery is I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness and not my behavior and not my experience and not my feelings. Clancy talks about if there ever was a flag that all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous could pledge their allegiance to, the flag would say, but I'm different. If you're truly different, you're going to die in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't be so different that you cannot identify. You can't be so different if you're too different. I'm not going to believe that what worked for Charlie would work for me. You have to make that identification. You have to take down that wall and become part of. You cannot be different. You cannot stand apart, too far apart, or you're not going to make it. And I tore that wall down, and I made the discovery that I'm not different, and I started to have a sense of hope that maybe what worked for you would work for me. And I started to have a sense of hope as I sat around those meetings after the meetings and listened to you talk about life. You didn't talk about drinking. You talked about life and life's problems. I listened to my sponsor with the other people that he sponsored, and they were talking about marriage, and they were talking about money, and they were talking about amends, and they were talking about work, and they were talking about life. And I was really kind of surprised when I first got there, because I thought they'd be talking a lot more about how not to drink. And there were some conversations about that, but not many conversations. It was mostly about how to apply the steps in your life. Well, I am sober now, a year to 2 years, and I'm starting to apply these steps to my life, and I'm not making much progress. And it seems like it's going the opposite direction. And once again, I'm starting to feel like I'm a guy who's a great starter and a poor finisher. You know, that everybody's patting me on the head in my first year and a half and telling me what a great job I'm doing. But all of a sudden I start to have problems that I don't think I should have, so I start to hide and cover them up. Sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, I start to build my wall back up. I'm starting to hide things that I don't want you to see. We go out to dinner after the meeting, and I buy in my checking account $50 overdrawn, but I buy because I'm a big shot. Okay. I sit in the AA club, and a new person comes in the meeting with a bushel basket full of problems that they got, and I greet them and tell them I'm really glad that they're there and they're in the right place, and I know they think it's hopeless. Speaking of newcomers, Dave, who has got 13 years of sobriety, you should have Dave as a talker this morning. I think he told me that the last time that he went to mail a letter when he was in a blackout, he drove his car into a post office. And they were a little upset about that. I don't know why they were. And he wanted to take me to lunch. I was a little concerned about that. But moderation is not one of Dave's problems. I just want you to know that. That's quite a stirring. So I'm starting to have these problems, and I'm starting to hide them. And I'm in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can talk a lot about my feelings, so I sound like I'm in a pretty good place, but I'm not letting you know about my financial problems, and I'm not talking much about my gambling problem. I'm talking somewhat to my sponsor about it. My sponsor knows pretty much what's going on, but he doesn't seem like he's as alarmed as I am about it. Well, my sponsor, I still am blessed with the same two men that sponsored me since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just on a hunting trip with my sponsor before I came here. And Warren's a real laid-back guy, and now that I'm 50 years old and I'm sponsoring guys that are 23 and 24, Warren didn't expect me to have my whole life together. Warren was concerned about my attitude in Alcoholics Anonymous and going to meetings and trying to apply those steps, and he knew I wasn't going to get my act cleaned up immediately anyway. And I thought he was just asleep. You know, there was this... Warren is not asleep. Warren has a great... He's 41 years sober this month, and he's a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been a blessing to me since the day I came in. But I'm ashamed that I got these issues, and I'm hiding them, and I'm starting to feel different in meetings, and I'm saying, God, you're all telling me I'm doing okay. Can't you see that my life's not okay? I mean, I'm in meetings with you 3 days a week, and I'm dying. You know, on my second year of sobriety, I'm having the issues, my third, fourth, fifth. By the time I'm into my fifth year, these issues are starting to eat my lunch. Now, I'm going to talk mostly for the rest of my talk about problems in sobriety, and I don't want you to make it sound like my time in Alcoholics Anonymous has been horrible. My time hasn't been horrible. You know what I thought recovery was? I thought recovery was the absence of problems. I don't know who told, no one told me that. I mean, I just thought... You know, I grew up with the idea that if you were a good Christian, you didn't sin. Okay, I thought that was it. Okay? I guess I heard everybody sin, but I thought that if you get to a place where you got it together well enough, you get to a place where you wouldn't. And I never made that standard. But I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It seemed to me, and this was my own goofy thinking, didn't seem to me like my sponsor had any problems. I mean, these people had jobs that they had for 10 or 15 years. They owned homes. They had automobiles that were paid for, some of them. I mean, they had a different set of issues. They had a stability in their life that I didn't have. Now, I know that they had issues, but I, for some reason, had a different standard for myself than I seemed to have for them. I kind of excused a few minor issues. It wasn't like they were hiding their lives from me, so they were not trying to be perfect. But when I had these issues, I felt dirty about them, like I have most of my life. And so they started to separate me. And sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, 5 years sober, I got my wall built back up, and I got two or three or four areas of my life that I'm not talking about regularly in meetings. And by my fifth year, this is really starting to eat my lunch. And while I'm talking to the newcomer, and I'm saying, you know, you're in the right place, and everything's going to be okay, and I'm really glad you're here, and you see that guy over there, Dave, God, his life was a mess, and now it's okay. Then I'd get in the car and I'd drive home 7 years sober and I'd say, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? When are you going to learn how to work? I mean, you don't stay at work enough. You go to work late, you leave early, you're down playing backgammon all afternoon. When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to stop spending money you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like, as Cecil talks about? When are you going to be kinder and more loving to your wife and your children? Okay. When are you going to stop gambling? I didn't have an answer for this because I'm stuck. And I've been stuck for a long time, and these are serious issues for me, and all of a sudden I'm starting to feel like a failure. I'm saying maybe alcoholism isn't my only problem. Maybe I ought to go to GA. Maybe I ought to do something about my spending. Maybe I ought to go to... You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered, I think all my life I wanted someone who knew Bob so well they could look through Bob. And I never found anybody who knew Bob that well. What happened to me is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered and I became an alcoholic. And I was surrounded by people who knew alcoholism. And I got understood in that context and it served me and I started to recover. Then as I moved through my sobriety, when I'm 6 or 7 or 8 years sober, all of a sudden I'm looking for an expert on Bob again. Because I think I've got my alcoholism handled. You handle my alcoholism, I'll handle my life. Now I know that that's not at all what the program talks about, but that for some reason I thought you were supposed to get me well, and I'd handle my gambling. I'd handle my sex life. I'd handle my marriage. I'd handle my parenting. I'd handle my job. And I wasn't doing that. Seemed like I was going backwards, and I was not going backwards. What was happening to me is I was, when you take a trip, if I said to Dave, tomorrow you're going home with me. Okay, well, before I said that, he didn't have that in his mind at all. But once I said that, he's got to find out what's in his way. He's got to get a plane ticket. He's got to make arrangements. He's got to change his schedule. When you start a process, you start to find out what's in your way, and that's what happened to me in my recovery. When I took that first step and I started my recovery, when you go forward, you find out what's in your way. The problems that I was running into were the problems that I had to deal with, and they're not identical for all of us. What is true is all of us leak. We just leak, in some of us, in different places. It isn't so important to where the leak is. It's just important that we know that we all leak. We talk about alcoholism being physical, but also mental and spiritual. When the physical goes away, the mental and spiritual don't go away. I still have the disease of alcoholism. It goes underground. It's still active. It expresses itself in different ways. And I think that my alcoholism expressed itself in compulsive behavior in my life. I got some of the same feelings when I gambled that I used to get when I drank. I kind of dropped out. It was, for me, gambling was like going to a bar. I could sit down and gamble for 8 hours at a stretch. And I got the drop out of life for that period of time. But when I'm 7 years sober, these issues are starting to tear my life up, and I'm starting to feel, I'm getting ideas of suicide, I'm getting ideas that my program's lousy, I'm getting ideas that maybe AA isn't enough for me, and I'm really stuck. And I went back to the steps with a ferocity that I had not been at them for a while, and I took step one, 7 years sober, and I found out what powerlessness and unmanageability meant to me. I took step two, and I made a discovery that I had lost the power of step two in my life. Step one was pretty easy for me to take. It was profound, but I knew I was powerless, and I knew I was unmanageable. But step two, I believe for us that God will restore us to sanity, but I lost the belief for me. I mean, I could have put my hand on the lie detector and said, you believe God's going to restore Dave to sanity? The answer is yes. But I had lost the belief that he's going to restore me to sanity because I'm 7 years sober and my life's a zoo. I had to come to believe... Again, 7 years or 8 years sober, that God would restore me to sanity. And I came, all of a sudden I was allowed to start to see the miracles that were happening around me. And I started to see people who had problems that were more serious than me walk through them with more dignity and with a smile on their face. And I started to see the power of the AA program in their life, and I started to believe it again for me. I took step three with my sponsor on my knees in his office. I did a new four step for the third time. I took a fifth step with my sponsor when the other two times I had done it with the clergy. And I said, be careful when you're done, whatever you recommend to me, I'm going to go do. And one of the things he recommended to me is that I go to a psychologist because I had a lot of issues around money and work and success. My dad was a real successful guy, and I think I thought I was supposed to be as successful as my father, and I wasn't. And I had a lot of hang-ups. And one of the things I got in touch with a psychologist, was how afraid of failing I was. If you can't fail, you can't play. I was a guy who was on the football team. I had the uniform. I rolled around in the grass. I got stains on it. I did the calisthenics. When they blew the whistle to block and tackle, I went up in the stands because I don't block and tackle. Okay. I'll tell you something about life is there are no stands. There's no place to hide. Okay. So I'm a salesman who doesn't make sales calls. kind of hard. It kind of slows down your record when you're kind of, you know, I don't even make it out, you know, accidentally, like someone could force me to buy something from, you know. I just falsify my expense reports. You know, I don't even make the calls. And I don't even get in the game. I'm afraid that if I put it all on the line, you'd find out that no one was home. I'm the guy who looks good but doesn't perform. And I was so afraid of failing, I wasn't playing, and I get in touch with that, and I thought like failure was like dying. And what I found out, if you would have asked me what was one of the dominant negative characteristics of my life, I would have said anger. After going to that psychologist and after doing a new inventory, I would have told you fear. Anger was my response to fear. And so many times when I was in front of my children, and so many times when I was in front of work, and so many times when I was in front of financial issues in my life, I was immobilized by fear. And I got in touch with that fear, and when I took that third inventory, my life, the way I looked at there, actually my fourth inventory, I started to get in touch with some things, and it literally has altered the way that I have seen the way I interact with my life. And I started to get a sense of hope. I made appointments after I took that fourth and fifth step, and when I was with the psychologist, I used to promise my sponsor I'd make appointments to go to work and stay at work. I'd have to take the big book out on sales calls. I'd sit out in the parking lot reading the third step prayer to get my body out of the car to go make the call that I knew wouldn't work. And all of a sudden I went out and I made a call and I made $1,000 on a sales call. And I thought, wow, if a guy did that regularly. You know, I mean, it was kind of this whole idea, you know. It was kind of like this thing went through my body that I thought, you know, God, I've been making a living gambling. You could make a living by working. You know, I mean, it was just a, you know, kind of brilliant, you know, sort of thing. Not too long after I had been at that psychologist, I had one of the worst days I ever had in AA. I went to work late and left early and got into a game and missed the meeting and missed dinner and got in a fight with Linda and slapped one of the kids. It was one of those days you would have liked to have had a videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do for you. And I was really feeling bad, and I said, gee, it happened again. I'm saying, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? It's your life. I'm saying, yeah, but it's so habitual. It's like these patterns are so well ingrained, I don't even have to think about them. It's like I do them in a blackout. And all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. That my life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. I sounded like a guy who didn't want to gamble. I was a guy who wanted to gamble whenever I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble for and not have problems because of gambling. I sounded like a guy who wanted a good relationship with his kids. I wanted my kids to love me without spending time with them. I sounded like a guy who wanted a good marriage. I wanted my wife to love me without spending time with her. I wanted money without working. That's not the design of life. And all of a sudden I realized that I had designed my life the way it was, and I was in deep doo-doo. I don't know why it is that in the process of recovery, it seems like you can try and fail and try and fail and try and fail and try and fail, but there comes a time where you got to change. I think there comes a time where you know enough in your recovery, where God has matured us enough in our program, where you got to choose. And those of us from that point on, if you choose, growth stops or substantially stops. And I think I was at that turning point of 7 or 8 years of sobriety. I don't think you can get this whole program in a year or two. I think sometimes between 5 and 10 years of sobriety or somewhere along that isn't so important. The time you're going to get it handed to you again. I think you're going to be faced with decisions where you're going to have to get your recovery and the power of God into the arenas of your life, into your whole life. And I had God in segments of my life, but I didn't have him in other areas of my life, and I had to put my whole life in the game. And that night I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to change my life, and I had failed, and I was allowed, and I realized that I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I was allowed to take the 6th and the 7th step of the program of AA. The 6th step said that we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and the 7th step said that we humbly ask and remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of my defects of character. I don't have the power to get rid of my defects of character. It happens through me, but not by me. God has the power. I'm the pipe. I'm not the well. The way we change is a doctor doesn't heal, and you know, a doctor creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. The farmer doesn't grow. He creates a fertile soil, plants a seed, creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows. And we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. It's the attitude, I think, of the sixth and the seventh step and the three requirements of being honest and open-minded and being willing. That night, out of fear of staying the way I was, I got down on my knees, I took the sixth and the seventh step, and five of the major problems in my life went away. Now, when you're going to make a major change in your life, you often have to have a structure for that change to take place. I'm a guy who, when I go on a diet, the first thing I do is I buy a bag of cookies and a little ice cream. Well, it's the last day I'm going to eat. I just, it's already been kind of a bad day. I'm just going to finish it out. I'm probably never again going to have any ice cream. And I just, and tomorrow, God, I'm going to eat just like I'm supposed to, forever. If you understand that, you understand that I have made a lot of promises to myself that I've not been able to keep. But when I took that sixth and seventh step, I started to put in structure to help me change the areas of my life. God let me know what I was supposed to do. I turned the finances over to the domestic finances over to my wife. My wife did not have the issue with money that I had. She doesn't have the ego. She had this new technique where she could pay a third of a bill. I thought, God, that's just awesome. They might think you don't have the money if you only pay a third. But she'd do that three times and the bill would get paid, Just really something. And we put me in an allowance. And I thought Big Shot shouldn't be in an allowance, but I went on an allowance and that worked out pretty good. I started to date my wife. I've dated my wife every Friday night for about the last 20 years. And when I'm gone, we date some other night. See, I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's love and affection I wanted. I had to learn how to be with my wife romantically again. It was a real live, dangerous date. We did not go out with anybody else. It's the two of us. We know that one night a week, at a minimum, we have each other's undivided attention. I spent 15-year-old. High maintenance group. Two of them are in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one's just starting high school. And I have a good relationship with my sons today. That's a joy to me. One of the things in my family, my father, as wonderful as my father was an angry, dominant man. And some of the ways I was in my family was a replay of how my father was, and from what I know of my grandfather, similar, wonderful men, great qualities. They were loving guys, but they were scary guys. And one of the things that I love, I know that I am, from what I can tell, the fifth generation of alcoholic in my family. My great-great-grandfather came over here from Switzerland and sent in for a cure for alcoholism when he was 35 years old, the father of seven kids, and died for what they sent him in the mail. He took it and blew his liver apart. He died when he was 34 years old. I was able to stop the cycle of alcoholism in our family. My brother's in the program, my father got in the program, and our family now has an idea, my two sons are in the program, my family has an idea what you do about alcoholism. Because of the steps in my life, when I was 8 years sober, I started to change the pattern of rage in our family. And I'm so grateful today that I have a loving relationship with my kids, that fear is not one of the dominant elements in the relationship with me with my children. And that's a gift that I think will go on giving in our family for an awful long time, and that's one of the, and I think there are, thank God that this alcoholism isn't just physical, that I can be active in the program and apply those principles to my life and still can learn things that can literally change my life when I'm 8 and 15 and 20, 25 years sober. When I made that change in my life all of a sudden took off like it was in a rocket ship. My work life started to take off, and I was kind of in the right place at the right time, and I started to make a lot of money. And I made enough money to burn a wet elephant. God, it was just wonderful. I was in the real estate investment business, and it was just, there was no limit to what I could do, and I bought big cars and big houses, and I could do whatever the hell I wanted to do. And for 10 years, I had the wind at my back, and everything I did worked. And I think that was, you know, I think if you would have asked me 10 years ago, would I want a life full of pleasure, or would I want a life that's more ordinary up and down? I would have said I want a life full of pleasure. I would answer that question differently today. I want a real life. I think life is not, and recovery is not, the absence of problems. I think if you're going to be in life, and you're going to be around Alcoholics Anonymous in your recovery over an extended period of time, in the 20 or 30 or 40 years you're going to live in your sobriety, you're going to have marital problems. You're going to have work problems. You're going to have money problems. You're going to have health problems. You're going to have kids that give you problems. You're going to have, someone's going to die. Life is going to happen, and it doesn't mean anything. It is life is going to happen. You're going to have a program and a depth and a power to deal with the issues in your life. But during those 10 years, I was on a roll, and about everything that I wanted to have happen, happened. And it was one of the most shallow periods of my life. That was the bad news. The good news is I do shallow well. A lot of people aren't, you know. I mean, it was, my life became about what I wanted. If I wanted something, I went and did it. And I developed an arrogance that I was unintended, but I developed an arrogance. I started to have an attitude that I was being blessed because I was such a good guy and an active member of AA. That wouldn't be a great thing to be around, you know, I mean. In about 1986, they changed the tax act, and I started to lose everything I had. I got a spiritual advisor in about 1988. And I went to this man, and he said, Bob, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want two things. I want to be less materialistic, and I said I'd like to be more loving. And within about 2 weeks, I started to lose everything I had. And I went back to this guy, and I said, we need to talk. I said, what I meant to say is I wanted to keep the things and not have them be so important to me. We still laugh about that. I mean, it's literally true. Within about a month after I went to see this guy, I literally started to lose everything I had, and I came within a quarter of an inch of going bankrupt. At 20 years of sobriety, I found myself faced again with the issues that I was facing in my first 2 or 3 years of sobriety. I was faced with failure. I was in the investment business. I invested a lot of money for people that I, for guys and women, men and women that I went to high school with. I'm in this town, and every place I go, you know, for the first 10 years in my business, I made everybody money, and then for the second 10 years or 5 years, everybody started to lose when they invested with me. And so every place I went, I saw relatives and people who had relied on me, and it hurt them. And so I was faced with issues about me that were just about as painful as I could be. All of a sudden, I'm back on a budget. You know, I haven't been on a budget for a hell of a long period of time, and I thought I had handled all my financial problems. Hell, I didn't handle them. I just made so damn much money, it didn't make any difference. And I am back into issues. I'm 22, 23 years sober. As you've got the attitude that God's blessing you because he's giving you so much money, when you start to lose it, you kind of went with the attitude that you're, something's wrong with you. And maybe God's punishing you. And I'm in, you know, at 22 years of sobriety, I got one child in the program, and at 25 years of sobriety, my other kid's in treatment. And I used to go over, and I'd go over to that halfway house Friday night for the meetings where my son was, and I'd start to cry. Tears would just come to my eyes. I'd sit down on the seat, they'd start the meeting, and tears would just flood out of me. And I couldn't tell you all what it was about. But, you know, it's always kind of nice when someone says, God, that guy over there has got 22 years. What the hell's wrong with him? You know, it's kind of a... I was in a lot of pain, and it wasn't much fun. And I felt like a failure. I mean, I really felt like something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with my program. And it wasn't, you know, just life. Just life. Just pain. I mean, if you're going to have, you know, what I wanted, life without pain is like a series of thrills. It's like eating sugar all the time. I mean, it's kind of fun, and it tastes pretty good. But as a steady diet, it isn't going to do nutritionally what you need to do. Life is meant to be full of joy and meant to be full of peace, and it's meant to have texture. And you don't learn much from the most pleasant times of your life. They're pleasant. But I'm telling you that the definitive times of my life were the times when I was down, the times when I had trouble. And they were definitive because God was trying to give me a message. The universe was trying to give me the message. And the message was,
is it's not working. It's not working. Okay. Now, I was a hard guy to get that message to. It would sometimes take quite a number of years to get that message to me. Things that my wife, you can get the message to Linda much quicker than you can get the message to me. It takes, I have a harder shell. I have more defenses. I have more denial. My wife is a very active member of Al-Anon. She does not have the barriers to a lot of things that I see that she needs to learn. She seems much more... she is naturally receptive. And I have a new thing that I recommend to the people that I sponsor for doing. You know, the fourth step is kind of hard in the book. You know, it's kind of got to have all these columns and stuff like that. And people get kind of confused with it. And I have a new way to do it. And I'm going to kind of recommend it to the General Service Office, but they haven't been very receptive yet. And what I recommend is that if you're a guy and you're married, that you get your wife in a room. And if you have kids, get your kids, a couple of brothers and sisters, and your parents, if they're still alive, a couple of creditors, a co-worker, your sponsor, and two people from your group. And get them in the room, and then you go in and you say, look, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have an inventory step that we try to find out things in our lives that don't work, and I've been having trouble identifying things in my life that are negative, and I was wondering if you could help. And then serve coffee and leave. Do you know why we're all laughing at that? We wouldn't call the meeting. Do you know why we wouldn't call the meeting? I mean, we sound like we don't want to, you know, we sound like we want to change. We don't want to change. Change is like dying. Not only do we not want to change, we don't even want to know. My spouse is often trying to tell me things I don't want to know. It's like a pretense, you know. I mean, a lot of us are in AA and we make friends with people. And I said before, you reach a crossroads where you got to change. If you don't change, what happens is you start hanging out with people that you make deals with. Look, I'm not going to call you on your crap. You don't call me on mine. We'll talk about the steps and the traditions and the principles, but we're not going to talk about the zebra I got tied out in the garage. We're not going to talk about them. Okay? You start to hang out with other people that got zebras. You know, you got a little subgroup, you know, with zebras. What you do is you start to accommodate your defects of character. You start to build an addition onto your house to accommodate them. And it starts to slow your life down immeasurably. It is crazy that we don't want to change. There's a guy who wrote a book, Scott Peck, who wrote a book called Road Less Traveled, and he wrote a new one not too long ago called Further Along the Road Less Traveled, and one of the things, there's a chapter in there called A Road to Omaha, and it's about death and dying. And he talks about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's steps about death and dying, you know, that there's denial and anger and then bargaining and depression and acceptance. And he talks about how you go through those phases. And he said, most people think you go through those phases when you're dying, only you don't. He said, you go through the first three phases. You go through the denial that's going to happen to you. You go through the anger that, you know, why is this happening to me? You go through the bargaining that, God, if you take this away from me, I'll devote my life to you and my life will change. And then you get to the depression. And the depression is so painful that most people don't go through the depression to acceptance. They back off and go back into anger and denial. And then he said something that I thought was so interesting. He said, and these are the same phases that you go through with major changes in your life. And I have found that to be true with me. And what has happened is I'll go through the denial. I know that, you know, that's no problem for me. And I go through the anger and the bargaining. I don't want to change. Change is like dying. The problems in my life are not new. The serious issues in my life have been around all my life. They're persistent. They're persistent because my problems are my solutions. They're techniques that I have developed to meet life situations. They don't work. But they're mine. They're familiar. I've had them a long time. They're my techniques, and I got them filed under answer. I don't have them filed under problem. And I can think intellectually change that, but boy, deep down in my heart, they're filing their answer. And when I get into a situation that I think needs that solution, it comes up on my computer and I go apply it. And I don't want to change because change is too threatening to me. It's like changing my view of the world. It's like dying. And Tom said the other night that what God would use, first he would reduce to nothing. The power of our program is in surrender. We have to get out of our own way. We have to empty ourselves out to have the room that God could fill us with the message, that truth could come in. I have never had a major change in my life happen without me first being emptied out. The problems of my life literally are the opportunities of my life. And I don't know why my ego and my intellect doesn't want to deal with it, does not want that answer. But my heart wants the answer. When I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm more connected to my heart. I'm more connected to my intuition. I'm more connected to the truth, and I'm more connected to my God than I've ever been in my life. I'm active in AA not for a drinking problem that I had 27 years ago, but for a living issue that I have today. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous today so that I can use the 12 principles of the steps of the program of AA on the mental and spiritual aspects of Bob. I need that growth today. I still have a lot of moving parts. I still have a very busy mind. I have, for some reason, after the International, in the last couple of months, I've been a goofy. You know, just, I have been very tense, kind of aggravated, you know, very short, very critical of the people around me. I don't know why the hell that is. You know, I've been working on it, I've been meditating, I've been reading, I've been trying to do the things that I'm supposed to do, and that's just the way I am. I get periods of time where I get complicated, and sometimes not so much fun to be around. And my wife, you know, I mean, we're both 27 years in the program, and she gives me my space, and we're talking about it, and I'm working on it, but, you know, I can't snap my fingers. One of the things that I have learned about the program is that the program is not mechanical. I think that there is power going through the steps in a mechanical sort of way. I think you can never hurt yourself by going to the steps and going through the process. But if the steps were mechanical, all we'd have to do every time we had an issue was take the third step prayer and click our heels, and we'd be back in Kansas. There'd be no problem. But don't hear me say that the third step doesn't work. I'm just telling you that it's not mechanical, it's spiritual. And that many times when I have a problem and I say the third step prayer, no one's home. That it all of a sudden doesn't get me out of the issue. That, you know, that I'm still mired and stuck in what I'm dealing with. So there's something else that has to take place. There's an attitude. There's a way of being, not just doing. The steps are not just about doing. There's a way that I have to be in the process of taking those steps, become part of the fabric of my life to change me. I don't know all of what that is, but I know one of them is surrender. I know that there's a humility that I have to bring to the steps in order to change. I know that there's a level of honesty that I have to bring that I often cannot summon to change. And so sometimes when I wonder about why the power of the program isn't there, it isn't there because I'm up in my head. I'm mechanically doing something, saying, you know, help me. And it isn't until I get enough pain, that I get the attention, that I get the humility, that I get a willingness to surrender, because I don't know how you surrender on demand. But I know without a question in my mind that I went through one of the toughest periods of time in my life when I lost most of my money and I lost my wealth, and I had to find out who I was without my money and without my prosperity. And I got grounded again in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and today I am happily married and in love with my wife and got a good relationship with my kids, and I'm self-supporting through my own contributions. I came through that valley. I didn't like being in that valley at 23 or 24 or 25 years of sobriety. I felt like I shouldn't be there, and I felt like I was a failure. And it just was what was. I mean, I got a buddy of mine, and I got to give Tom the number, who's got cancer right now. And I remember that, you know, when we were, the guy's 20 years sober, and he was in his room, and his wife's crying. And there was a bunch of people in there, and they were trying to just worried about all the things that you worry about when you got cancer. Is it terminal? You know, and is it, you know, what can they do? And Bill looked up and said, look, it just is what it is. It is what it is. It's just, life's the way it's supposed to be. It just, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm going to take it one day at a time. It just is what it is. And most of my life, I've been unwilling to stand in front of it and say it is what it is. But when I stood in front of my alcoholism and said it is, my life changed. At 8 years of sobriety, when I stood in front of my sex life and my money and my marriage and my parenting and my gambling and said it is, the power of truth changed my life. So to the extent that I can have, I think I am meant to get well in the community. I don't get well alone. I know more than I've ever known. At 27 years, I've read a hell of a lot. I've studied the steps. I know a lot of things. My knowledge does not seem to change my life. My heart needs to be touched. And it is in community with you that I get touched. It is in community with you that I hear what I'm supposed to hear. It is in community with you and my sponsor that I am more honest than I am when I'm alone. I treasure my life with you. Thank you.